Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experience within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I am here with Andy Lower, who is an entrepreneur, investor, and advisor, and has taken on various roles as a leader in the impact investing space. He manages two funds, and now maybe it's more than that, but that's what I know. Recently, you've become an author, so you can talk about that. And then just to set some background, we met 8 years ago, right when I was getting into this impact investing space at a conference in Mexico. We sat at a table, your wife was there, and it's one of those things where we just instantly connected and had a great conversation. Then we just reconnected a couple of weeks ago at a conference. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Great to be here. And generally, it's been good to catch up with you more recently, but also been good to watch your journey since we spoke 8 years ago. So it's interesting to see how the space is all evolving, and great job with the podcast.
Well, I'm anxious to hear, to the extent that it comes out today, some of the lessons you've been in this space for some time. Why don't you do this? You have a very cool accent, which means you come across extremely smart, which I believe is true. But give us, like, where'd you grow up? You know, obviously where you grew up, we went to school, and just a high level of your career so we can get a background of who you are.
Yeah, I've been working pretty hard on the accent for a number of years and still managing to put it off. So I'm English, and I still am British with a British passport. And I've been in the US for 20 years because I got married to my Californian wife. We met 22 years ago when she was over studying in the UK, and then moved across to the US after that. But I grew up in the UK, just outside of London, a town called Harpenden, up near Luton Airport. And did all my education in the UK. I think with regards to my life journey in impact investing, from a very early age, I've been very passionate about poverty issues and the role that individuals have to make a difference in that. The starting point for me was with the Live Aid work in the mid 80s. And as a young child, I was shocked by what I was seeing about the man-made famine in Ethiopia. And I persuaded my parents to do some bring and buy or bake sale or whatever it was, that we could raise some money to stop the famine that was heading north from Ethiopia. And since then, I've really been involved in kind of poverty issues. When I was 18, I spent a year out and lived in Central America, studying Spanish in Guatemala, and then working with kids in the slums of Costa Rica and helping them to get an education. So when I had that opportunity, it was really eye-opening to me just the importance of education and how fortunate I was to have the opportunities I did. And so I came back from that experience and went to university and did law as an undergrad degree at the University of Southampton, where the Titanic set sail from. And then I did a master's degree in international development with work experience and started working for a couple of NGOs in the UK. And then after that, I got my bar training. So I'm a qualified barrister. I'm a lawyer that can ask questions, even if I'm not a practicing lawyer. And so that's kind of my background educationally. And like I said, I've been in the US for 20 years working in various different groups and organizations, but all focused on impact investing in various different degrees.
So what was it about poverty that drew you in? Why is it such a big issue in your mind? Anything you can shed on that front?
Yeah, I don't think it's rocket science for my life journey. My parents are quite conservative, and I grew up in a conservative family upbringing that had values. I found it frustrating that the communities that I was connected with weren't necessarily living into those values as perhaps as much as they could do. And especially with regard to poverty issue, where it really is the lottery of postcode, zip code, whatever you want to call it, that I could have been born in a very different situation. The more that I've worked in extreme poverty, the more that I know I don't understand extreme poverty, because I'll never be in that situation just because of the opportunities that I've had because of where I was born. So to me, that is really generally a lottery. And to see that certain people had different opportunities than others just because of where they were based was really eye-opening for me. And I think the empathy just really is the key to be able to try to understand other people's positions that are so very different than ours, even if I'm not going to fully understand it, to be constantly trying to understand where people are coming from, to understand the different mindset, the different worldview that people have, I think is really important. And that is lived out professionally in what I'm trying to do.
Do you have a sense of, if you had grown up in the United States, this is a hard question, but if you had grown up in the United States, versus where you grew up. Do you have any sense of how that would have changed your trajectory or even your mindset on this, or would it matter?
I don't know that it would necessarily be as general. I've got lots of opinions, some of which I'll share on the podcast, but lots of them keeps myself on. Having traveled around the US as well, I think the United States is a whole different variety of different personalities and different people, having lived in different states within America. So I don't think it would be necessarily different with a different worldview. I do think there are challenges and opportunities. I think it's one of the sad things that we've seen in the last few years is when isolationist mindsets are the name of the game. I've loved traveling. I've loved experiencing different cultures, and I've loved seeing different opportunities. And I've been very, very fortunate to be able to travel. I've been very fortunate to have the freedom and the security and the safety to be able to experience lots of different cultures and working with different people across different national boundaries. So I don't know that my upbringing would necessarily be different if I was born in the US. I am a dad of two kids, a 14-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl. And obviously being brought up here in the US, they're both Californian passport holders. Or should I say American passport holders born in California. And so I think that it's a question of what is the opportunity that we want them to have? What is the worldview that we want them to have? How do we want them to live into their values as kids, both being born in the US, but also having a British dad? So I don't think it's a British-American piece, but I do think it is trying to think through what the different opportunities there are to be able to experience the world in its fullness. And, you know, we have one shot at this life, as far as I can see, and I want to live it to the fullest extent I can. And I believe I will be held accountable for the way that I live my life in whatever form that takes. And I want to make sure that I'm doing the best I can with the amazing opportunities that I've been given.
One last question that relates to geography, and then we'll get off that subject. If you were talking to a group of Americans around impact investing versus a group of Europeans, would that be a different discussion?
Yes. But again, I think there's more nuances than that. So okay. When you say a group of Europeans, I think that would be very different. I grew up English, maybe British, not European.
Okay. Fair enough.
And I think that's become even more extreme with the new Brexit reality. So European, I think, needs to get defined. Even within continental Europe, it becomes more nuanced. And then I think the same thing with the US. Having said all of that, one of the things that I love living, even with the challenges that I think America is currently experiencing, one of the things I've loved is living in the US and having the genuine entrepreneurial go get them attitude that comes with American investors. And that fits in with my personality, that mindset that people bring to what can be done rather than what should be done or what hasn't been done. And I really fully embrace that. And I do find there is alignment with Americans. That being said, I work with a bunch of European, British and continental European investors, and they have that same mindset too, just because of the way that they think about the world. So I don't think it's necessarily black and white, but I get the point that mindsets that people have. And I love being in the US. I love being with people that can see the potential in people. And I think that's the name of the game.
That's great. Well, thanks for the nuance answer there.
I feel like I'm walking a tightrope.
I know. I'm not trying to pin you in a corner. All right. So here's a big question. How would you best describe who you are in the context of where you're at in your life journey?
Yeah, I think that's a great question and not the easiest one to answer. I don't want to lawyer up and get even more difficult, but I've been spending quite a bit of time. I've been playing around with different settings on LinkedIn and trying to work out how I am defined in my high level summary and in my kind of one liner, in my paragraph, and how I define what my career path has been. The current wording is a visionary leader focused on innovation, entrepreneurship to change the world. And I held back on being as direct with saying things like to change the world because I didn't want to sound like I was cloud cooking. Crazy. And I'm kind of really living into that. I do believe that the world can be changed. And so that's kind of the starting point from it. I strongly and passionately care about innovation and social entrepreneurship. And I think that's the opportunity that I am in at the moment to be able to change the world. And I think my personal qualities, what I try to bring to Team World is a visionary mindset and a mindset of leadership that believes in getting things done, that believes in implementation, but also believes in seeing a world that could be there for more people to be a part of. So visionary leader is what I would call myself, but who actually gets stuff done.
Interesting. You said took out the word change the world, which is exactly the question I want to ask you is whether it's big, whether it's small, it doesn't really matter. And you may have already answered it, but specifically, how are you trying to change the world? And I think I know the way you're going to answer it, but if you could also go a layer deeper and maybe even give examples of how you're doing that.
Yeah, so I'd taken out the word change, the phrase change the world. I put it back in, a visionary leader focused on innovation, entrepreneurship to change the world. I believe that the world can be changed, and I believe that there can be a different reality. I think my specific role in that is focused on the extreme poverty angle. There's a lot of other ways to change the world, and there's a lot of other ways that the world needs to be changed. So for me, it's focused on extreme poverty, and then it's also thinking through what I can do in the position that I am with life, in terms of being able to connect with those that have amazing opportunities and resources, namely investors and those entrepreneurs who are actually changing the world on the ground, working with customers, working with those who have the impact that we want to see in the world by their lives being changed and breaking the cycles of extreme poverty. So I see myself as being able to kind of bridge the gap between those two worlds that are often far apart and not as connected as they could be. And I also see that my role and my way of being able to do that most effectively is being based where lots of investors are based, and being based here in the US. I would love to be spending my time in various different countries on the ground in the developing world, but I'm not sure that's where I could have the most impact for this season of life. And this season's been going on for 20 years, because I see that my ability to be able to have opportunities that lots of others don't have, in terms of, as a white male, being able to have conversations with other white men who are a lot more powerful, a lot wealthier than I am, is an opportunity that lots of social entrepreneurs don't necessarily get, and lots of the customers that they work with definitely don't get.
Knowing what you do practically day to day, or have done at least part of the time, are you saying that you feel like your conversations with investors and the capital side is maybe more where you have an influence going forward versus being on the ground with entrepreneurs? Or am I reading too much into that statement?
I think that's a good summary of it. I wouldn't say they're kind of either or. I think the only reason that I'm having conversations with people on the capital side is to see how they can be involved in changing the world. And the only reason I'm having conversations with the social entrepreneurs is to see how they can be involved in changing the world. I think the position that I'm at the moment on this journey is I have opportunities that other people do not have. And how do I live into those opportunities? And how do I live out what I'm feeling that I'm meant to be doing in this season? And so I believe that individuals can change the world. I believe in the power of capital. I believe strongly in capitalism and market opportunities. And it's a question of how that can be implemented, how that can be rolled out. There may be other opportunities that change soon, who knows? But at the moment, that's where I feel I am having an impact, and I'm feeling at peace with the role that I'm doing in changing the world.
Going on something you actually said, the power of capital. When did you realize the power of capital, whatever that means? And what does the power of capital mean to you?
Yeah, so I think there's different variations and different nuances, ways of understanding it. I was born in a middle-class family. We had money, but I wouldn't say we were particularly wealthy compared to those around us even. And so I think when I was living in Central America, I really saw the difference that connecting those that have with those that don't. Very simple of ways of bridging that gap was the name of the game, and that I could have a foot in both worlds and try and bridge the two together. Then when I was just after I'd moved to the US, I was working for a company called Geneva Global, and we were helping high net worth individuals to think through how to effectively give money away and to be more effective in their philanthropy. And you really saw the difference that high net worth individuals had to be able to use that capital effectively. We also did some investments with that capital, which then took me on to the next stage of the journey, which was running a foundation and transitioning them from doing traditional grant making, a 95% traditional foundation model, to actually getting 100% focus on impact, and transitioning from doing grants to actually using that same capital to make early stage investments. And the next level of that is using that same capital to be able to take the first risk, to be able to set up special purpose vehicles, a whole load of different subsidiary LLCs that were run by the nonprofits. So trying to think through how it could be nuanced to be able to get different types of capital in the cap structure, but also different types of capital based on motivation to be able to have a difference. And what I'm now doing with ADAP is using that relatively small amount of capital to invest very, very early in businesses that have high growth potential and massive impact potential. So I think it's being clear on what the capital opportunities are, but also trying to think through how you can push things a little bit more to be more consistent with the capital uses.
Let's deviate for a second here. To go deeper, you run two funds. This is not a sales pitch by any stretch. In fact, I don't even think you're raising capital. What have you been doing, and any lessons you can share from those endeavors over the last, whatever, 10 years, how long?
Yeah, so over the last 10 years or so, so the two funds, the first fund, 11 investments, and we had some really creative investment structures, a couple of exits that came from that fund, and it was quite creative in trying to think through. We came up with a structure, performance aligned stock, that tried to bridge the gap between equity and debt and making sure that it was aligned with the workers that we were working with, which was amazing. We got an award from New York, a group of lawyers. It was quite fantastic. It was very, very hard for an average investor to read and to understand. And it was also very, very hard to be implemented as well. So even though we were getting applause and plaudits for it, it was actually very complicated and actually not necessarily easy for other people to get on board with. So we did a couple of those kind of structures with Fund One, with Fund Two. Having learned the lessons from Fund One, we tried to keep things a bit more uniform, a bit simpler, you know, standard, safe, standard convertible notes that we're working with. We invest 75,000 to 100,000 per entity, which means we come in very, very early, because that's when that kind of relatively small amounts of capital can have a massive impact and a massive difference. And then the other piece of capital and the power of capital is the human capital. So we really focus on what we do with our third entity, which is ADAP Advisory. And ADAP Advisory has separate contractual relationships with each of the businesses and works with them post the investment from ADAP Capital. So ADAP Capital is going to be making an investment, investing early. We do a 4-hour due diligence process, which means we think we can reach a decision after only taking up 4 hours of the entrepreneur's time. A lot more time goes in behind the scenes on our end, but we don't want to be wasting the entrepreneur's time. And if we can't make a decision in that time frame, then it's clearly not meant to be and should be a no. But then we spend time 18 months post-investment really working with these entrepreneurs, really helping them to lay the foundation that they need to be able to grow the business, which I think is where the intellectual capital is most needed, as well as the time and energy that obviously requires some capital, which wouldn't really have the biggest impact. So in the bigger ecosystem, it's tiny amounts of money, but it's actually really profound, really impactful. And the companies that we're working with in Fund Two, we made 16 different investments. They are having an amazingly profound impact. The current summary that I have is that everything takes literally four times as long as you hope it would, which takes the pressure off when things are taking literally 8 years and it's where you'd hope to be after 2 years. That to me is now the new normal. So I'm recalibrating what that looks like and also encouraging entrepreneurs that it's a very much a bunch of sprints come together to become a marathon. And we've got to be patient and we've got to be understanding of how complicated it is to change the world. And that's both from the investor perspective, needing patience and needing empathy, as well as from the entrepreneur perspective, understanding just how challenging it can be. But every day I wake up and I'm excited because it is working and the world is being changed and hundreds of thousands of lives are being impacted each month by what we're doing with small amounts of capital.
If you could grade your model on the results, and if you could grade it on the impact, what would you grade it? If you could grade it on the financial, how would you grade it? Or is that too sensitive to...
I'll give you my barrister training answer. It's incredibly subjective. One of the things I think is always very interesting in the traditional financial world is benchmarking and how we decide how we're benchmarking against this and benchmarking about that. Who decides what the rules are for benchmarking? And I get there is compliance issues, SEC, sure. I get it. But it's also one of those things where it's like, okay, how are we deciding how one wants to work with our portfolio? So for example, I spoke with one of my investors who had some of his wealth advisors in the room. I'm a straight shooter. I tried to be honest with it. We had our PPM that had very few numbers in it because I wasn't going to be making stuff up. I gave the whole explanation as to why we were investing so early and using this social capital, kind of bridging the gap between traditional philanthropy and traditional market rate returns. How can we have this social capital? And my pitch is, if there's money to be made in this space, then we're the ones that are going to make it because we're coming in so early and we're able to structure things to be equitable for both us and the entrepreneurs. And so the investor turned to his wealth advisor and said, where would you put this on the spectrum of risk, the risk continuum? And he said, it's so far out there, it's not even on the spectrum. And the investor took it on board and then, you know, rang me up half an hour later and said he was excited to be investing and saw that as an opportunity. So I think it's one of those where, you know, his wealth manager was doing his fiduciary duty. His wealth manager was being clear about it. This wasn't I didn't feel it was pity money that was coming out. It was just an investor that saw the opportunity that got what we were trying to do, and he is looking to get some upside from his money, and he wants to get his money back, but he's also aware of the challenges that there is in the space and the reality of how hard it is for these early stage businesses. But that's how you change the world. And there's a bunch of other ways he can make a lot more money, not as life-giving, not as fulfilling of his calling in the world, but gives a bunch of money, which is what he could or couldn't do, depends on what his life journey is. So in terms of grading on it, I don't think it can be that kind of objectively decided. In terms of performance, you know, there's lots of lessons that I've learned. This is the second fund, still things I would be doing differently every day. There's a bunch of lessons that I've learned. You know, we can call them mistakes, but I'm trying to learn from them. I do make some mistakes. I don't learn from some errors that I make, but the most of it I'm learning from it. So it's all part of the life lesson journey. So I think we've got to just be honest about it and be real about it. You know, these businesses are structured really well. A lot of them have American holding companies or Western holding companies, but then local subsidiaries. They're all working on the ground, working with people that understand the local population they're working with. And they all have big enough visions to be able to see the world that could be. And with that requires capital and a lot of grunt work. So I don't think it's again, I've made the answer very long, but I don't think it's a nice, easy, objective, black and white numbering system that we all like to have because we like our boxes, because it makes it nice and easy for us to contextualize stuff.
Oh yeah. The boxes, I think of the style boxes in equity investing, and there's so many nuances and all that, but we've dumbed it down to, oh, it fits in this box. It's value, it's growth, it's small cap, whatever. So no, I appreciate your answer. And I actually appreciate your honesty. That's one of the things I love about the impact investing space. This is a general statement. When you have a more broad definition of success other than financial, I find that there's a more willingness to be open and honest about everything because it's much bigger than just financial side. So anyways, I appreciate that answer and I get that it's not a simple thing. What would you say to somebody who currently views capital in two buckets, my investment capital and my philanthropic bucket? Anything that you'd say or in a healthy way challenge on that? Because obviously your career, you were in philanthropy doing grants, and then you've switched over to the investing side. So any framework you can help us as you think about those kind of capital?
Great question, Jeff. I would just start with who decides what the rules are, and how do we in 2024 decide how we're going to be bucketing our capital? Is it because that's what the investment world and the philanthropic world have decided are the rules? Like, I get it, there's compliance rules, but in terms of what the rules of the game that we're playing on our life journey of my life game, I want to be here to change the world. And I want to be able to deploy different types of capital to be able to change that most effectively. You know, I've seen some amazing guarantee models. I am shocked that more foundations are not more involved in low risk, massive impact guarantee models that allows capital to be making good money while also being able to open up floodgates of other capital to be able to be deployed. I've also seen some amazing need for aid and need for grants, where capital just needs to be given away and generosity of capital needs to be given away. However, as a hardcore capitalist, I believe that we can use the forces of market forces in a good way to be able to bridge that gap. And I think if we are prepared to be honest about where the capital is being used, we're prepared to have a healthy emotional relationship with capital, then we can actually be a lot more effective in living into our values and living out how we want to be. I think that that is probably one of the biggest things that I find frustrating in the space and in the sector. I think there is honesty to some extent, but I think that a recalibration is often needed for us to be real about what we're trying to achieve. And I try to be honest with my entrepreneurs and say, okay, this is a win for you. This is a win for me. I'm an amazing set of lawyers that I've been working with to structure everything. And I would say 50% of the conversations I have with them is me negotiating against them saying, hey, this is great for me, but I don't see how that's good for necessarily the entrepreneurs, or hey, I don't see how that's necessarily as fair as it could be. Not because I'm some profound guru on it, but just because I'm applying a lens of what I consider to be common sense of equity and fairness, and in a way that is sometimes more challenging for them because that's not what they're doing in their typical 9-to-8 job. And it's a different way of calibrating it. So working with different ways of thinking, I think, is the name of the game to be able to live more effectively into values.
Yeah. And what I've seen, to add on to what you've been saying, is when you think about this philanthropic bucket, if we want to call it that, and the investment capital bucket, and you kind of break down the walls, it actually, and you used this word early on, it unleashes some some innovation and creativity to say, what can it look like if we rip these buckets apart? And what I have seen, or at least the last 8 to 10 years from what I've been doing, investors are starting to see their capital as capital, and they're seeing things they care about as things they care about. And if the right pocket is, you know, the philanthropic and the left pocket is investment capital, they're almost becoming agnostic to go, I want to be involved in this theme. At one level, it may be the philanthropic bucket. At the other, it may be the other. And frankly, if there are ways to do it together, we'll do it together. The problem is the investing world, the business world, they still don't have the tools in the vernacular to oftentimes address that type of person. But I'm seeing more and more where I think the financial advisory world is going to have to change and frankly, be forced to be more creative to meet a person as a whole individual versus I only work with one side of your brain or the other side of your brain. Have you seen that?
Yes, I think that 50% of it is the investing world and wealth managers and advisors kind of changing the way they offer things, they think about it. I think 50% or maybe even 90% of it is what I was writing about recently in my book, which we'll talk a little bit more about.
Yep.
I gave away all my clothes, values through social entrepreneurship. Who decides how I am going to live into who I am meant to be is on me. And so if I am a high net worth individual, if I'm a low net worth individual, I can decide how I want to use the capital that I have to be able to live into my values and live out who I want to be. And so the book talks about my personal journey in social entrepreneurship as I spent a lot of time reflecting on the performance of ADAP Fund 2, as well as a company called Visible that I helped to set up. It kept coming back to values and kept coming back to who I wanted to be and how consistent I was living into those values. And for me, buying clothes that I knew were being made in sweatshops was not living into my values. And playing with the fact that I could buy cheap clothes, which meant I could give more money away rather than actually just buying more expensive clothes, maybe, but clothes that I knew that had been made ethically, having less money to give away, but actually having an impact with the clothes that I was buying was a very, very simple but important recalibration. And the only way I got to that point was by literally giving all my clothes away and building a new wardrobe from scratch, seeing how complicated or how challenging that was, but also how impactful that was, and really living into it. And so I think that's a nuanced view or a one view on clothing, but I think it's something about social entrepreneurship as well that, and I keep coming back to it, who decides what the rules are and who decides how we've written the rules? For me, it's not acceptable in my world for me to be buying sweatshop made clothes when I know they're sweatshop made clothes. And I know there's alternatives to be buying more ethically made clothes. And I think it's kind of crazy that we have all these people that are kind of being honest in the space, but they're talking about this and talking about that. And it's great talk. And I'm like, yeah, but tell me more about your clothing. We can talk about, tell me more about your food. We can talk about different ways that are very simple and very granular, but that actually shows who we are and how we're living into our values that we claim to aspire to.
No, that's challenging. The truth is it requires, it's a lot of work to think through all these issues.
It is a lot of work. And we, again, I talk about in the book, the world is a lot grayer. The more that we try and think through these issues, the more grayness we see. And, you know, I talk about in the book about how I'd love for the world to be as black and white as I once thought it was, where it was very simple. And I think we humankind often strives for that black and whiteness because it provides clarity and provides boundary. It's a lot of ambiguity, a lot of nuance, a lot of the need for us to think through where we're at on the journey. And I talk about it again with clothing because at different stages of life, there's different models that one needs to have. I could give away all my clothes. My professional wife, who needs to make sure she had a variety of wardrobe, couldn't have the opportunity to give away her clothes in the same way I did. And so therefore she's looked at different recycling models. She's done Rent the Runway, different ways where she can have amazing professional looking clothes on a more consistent basis because that's what she needs to have. Whereas I can actually just embrace the fact that I could choose different companies that I was buying my clothes from. And again, I'm talking about clothing, but if we can choose that across the board, how we want to deploy capital, how we want to have an impact, and how we want to be creative in using that.
So when I first got into the impact space, which is when we first met, I don't know that I would say this to everybody, but in my head, what I felt like, and this is going to sound grandiose, so I get that it sounds grandiose. I don't mean it at that level. To me, I switched from traditional finance to impact really as a way to help redeem capitalism, because I'm a capitalist at heart. To your point, in your example, it's looking at the clothes. The problem to me with capitalism at one level is profits are the only metric. And so we're often not asking that next question. And so to me, just asking the question, and to your point, there's a lot of grayness. But if you at least start asking the question, it opens up affordable housing. What's the role of affordable housing? Should it be government subsidized? Should it not be government subsidized? Should we be charging market rent? Should we not be? Do you raise rents? Do you not raise rents? And just even thinking through that in the traditional capitalist model, it's if the market will bear it, you do it. And it's like, it may be a little more nuanced than that.
Yeah, again, so you said profit is the most important thing. Who decides that? Who has decided that is the role of capitalism? That's not how I view capitalism. And I also think to be sustainable, I want to have a fair win for them and a fair win for me, because that means that there's more opportunity for both of us. We can all get the pie to be bigger. That, to me, is a definition of capitalism, not just profit being the only one, the only thing that drives it. And short-term quarterly profits cannot be the only thing. And if that means I need to come up with another word and say I'm not a capitalist, I'm more than happy to put myself in a different word camp, impact investing. But I think that, you know, there's a decision that we all make when we come into using our capital as to how we are going to live into who we want to be. And we can decide, yep, we live in a complex world. Yep, there's lots of ambiguity, but we can decide who we want to be and how we want to live out our role in the world by how we use our capital and how we use our time and our resources. And I think that we need to think that everyone needs to be thinking that through, and everyone's going to be changing and adjusting and pivoting as you do with a business, as you do with life journey. And certain things that were black and white 3 years ago are going to be less clear now. And certain things that are black and white now are going to be less clear in 3 years' time. And that's all part of embracing that journey, embracing the reality of trying to live into our calling and what we're meant to be doing.
So I don't know if you use the word stewardship in your lexicon, but I've been hearing from my vantage point, I hear a lot of stewardship. How do you define stewardship, and how does that play out in what you do?
Yeah, I don't use stewardship on a regular basis. Not intentionally. I'm not against the word stewardship, but I do think of terms of how we're using our resources and our opportunity, which I guess is just a slightly different way of saying stewardship. And I think it's being consistent with what we have and what we have been, what we've typically been fortunate to get. Yep, we work hard. Yep, I think there is a direct correlation. When I was at university and I saw people leaving the exam room with 30 minutes to go because they thought they did it, I worked my buns off for the next 30 minutes every time, thinking, okay, I'm gaining 0.5%. Okay, I'm gaining 0.5%. Okay, I'm gaining 0.5%, because I worked really hard. And I would get to the bar and they'd already have their first drink and I would be absolutely drained because I've been working hard for the last half an hour. I get that, you know, what you work at can actually have an impact. And I also am very honest and very clear about the fact that there's the allocation of resources, the allocation of stewardship is not necessarily equal. And we each have a different part of the journey. Partly some people have more, some people have less. Partly some people have opportunities to be able to do more with what they have. Partly people need to have more because they're on a different journey to other people. So I think being honest about it and being real about it, what I would say is I think that we can change the way that we think about it. Like we talked about the right hand, the left hand. I also think we can change the way that we talk to each other. My big thing is empathy and education and being empathetic to other people and trying to educate oneself to be able to understand other people's worldview. Be that understanding more of the hardcore capitalist view, be that understanding more of the hardcore socialist view. I think that's really, really critical for us as humankind to be able to have the bigger impact that we're looking to have.
A lot of this stuff, you gotta dig into it. And it's really almost example based and whatnot. But anyways, in closing, and I'll leave it open as you can, anything you want to say in closing. If you could have a dream come true for your life, what would that be? I always say this because I'm assuming most people would say family. So if you want to leave that out and go more to the discussion we're having, you can, and you won't sound like a pig because you didn't mention your wife or kids.
I love my wife and kids, and I am so fortunate to be blessed with the family that I have. And I am so thankful for them, and I'm so thankful for their role directly in my work, both in terms of giving me the opportunity to be able to embrace more risks, as well as giving me the challenges with my kids, especially on a daily basis, for me to try and be the best of myself and to be a better version of myself. So I 100% agree with that. In terms of, you know, we talked a lot about different cliches, lots of different wording. I think you mentioned examples, and I think that's the name of the game. And that's something that I'm driving towards every day in terms of how are we impacting the farmers that we're working with in Zambia by one of our investments that we invested very, very early that now ADAP has whatever tiny little percentage on the cap table because the entrepreneur has gone on to raise a few million dollars, is impacting over 100,000 people each month. We are a blip on that. People don't even know our name that's associated with that, you know, catalytic capital, maybe you want to call it, or just first risk capital, whatever you want to call it. We are having an impact on those farmers directly because of us being able to willingly embrace that risk. I think of a call that I have in 10 minutes with a couple of entrepreneurs that are trying to think through how they can be getting more animal vaccines to the most rural communities in Ghana and how they're really struggling to get the margins up to be able to get that sustainable business, just because the margins are not there to be able to get where they would like to be able to be attractive for venture capital type money. And so how do they work through the nuance of very, very slow growth? Meanwhile, they're continuing to impact thousands of lives. I've got a call later on this morning with another entrepreneur in Ghana working with students and trying to think through income share agreements and trying to think through the nuance of how we're structuring the deals to be fair for the students, but also be fair for our investors, to be able to de-risk it, aware of human behavior, but also aware of the fact that we want to find as many students as we can to be able to come, to be able to get those educational opportunities. So I think those real life examples, that's the legacy that's being written. As our due diligence process is, I talked about the 4 hours, you know, the three things that I look at is do I understand the business model enough to be able to get what the business is about? Do I trust the entrepreneur and I feel the entrepreneur can look me in and I feel good about it? And then the third is, do I want it on my obituary? And that's my big thing about this kind of question is, what do we want to have on our obituary? What do we want to be known as? How do we want to be remembered? I had two amazing dogs. My first dog was called Shaftesbury and it was named after Lord Shaftesbury, who was a social reformer in the UK, did an amazing work with all of the opportunities he'd been given, both in terms of doing prison reform, in terms of doing working week reform, did amazing work. And then at his funeral, the streets of London were crowded on a rainy day when they all came out to celebrate the life that this man had had with the resource he'd been given. And so to me, that's a driver. I named my dog, which I'm not sure is necessarily too honoring of his legacy. But the reason I named my dog Shaftesbury was to remind myself on a daily basis that individuals can change the world. You, me, whoever else listens to the podcast has unique opportunities to be able to change the world. And we've got to embrace that and live into that. And we've got to be deciding who we want to be, how we want to live out those values on a daily basis. So I hope that I'll live a life that has impact. I hope that I'll live a life that can see tangible change in the world. And I hope that I'll be true to myself and the best version of me more than not.
That was drop the mic. You did a great job. That was really good. Well, I think you all get a sense of why we immediately resonated, whatever, 8 years ago. And his wife is just as dynamic. That's a whole nother discussion. But thank you for your time. And we wish you well in your endeavor. And I'm not going to ask this question, but because I think people see it. We talk about impact investing, oftentimes focused on the capital and how it's making a difference. I'm equally as enthralled with how investing this way changes the heart and psyche of the investor. I see in you what it's doing to your own heart and psyche. I didn't need to ask the question because you're living it. And I hope that people can get involved in impact investing in this regard because it is a meaningful endeavor. You can lose money, but you also can make a massive, massive difference. And you think about, but you can lose money in a traditional investment, just the same. So might as well do it something that you can get behind. And then the last thing I'll say is, because you talked about some stuff in Africa, we do some stuff in Africa, and I love getting people to invest in this stuff because it pulls their heart towards Africa, and hopefully they see them in a different light. And in fact, last thing I'll say is, nothing wrong with philanthropy, especially Africa. I mean, Africans want to be viewed as investment worthy. And so there's a quite an opportunity to change the mindset that, yes, you need charity. But a lot of them are like, don't view me as a charity. View me as an equal and I'm investable. I don't know if you have any 2 cents you want to add to that. But
100%. Who makes the rules? Who is deciding that they are different than us? And who is deciding that we don't believe that they are investable? Talking with any entrepreneurs, both on the African continent and outside of Africa, you know, there's that same entrepreneurial mindset that I bring to what I'm doing with the nuance of the work that I'm in. But there's some amazing, game-changing, visionary people that have not been given the same opportunities that I have that are massively changed the world. So again, who decides on these aid models? Who, you know, yeah, we can get into colonial powers and all the rest of it. I mean, who decides on whether or not they are going to be investable or not? We need to be able to meet people where they're at, understanding the mindset that they bring to Team World, and how can we be a part of helping them be the best themselves for the great, the good, beyond our own small world. So what can we do for the greater good of team world?
Thus, common good. See, I mean, there's linkage there.
That's a good, wouldn't that be a great name if that was?
That would be a great name. Anyways, thanks so much for joining. Don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. Andy, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.